Just a quick word from our sponsor, Panacea Financial, providing banking built for doctors by doctors. Hear what Dr. Michael Juergens, a MedPeds physician and co-founder of Panacea Financial, had to say.
When I became an attending, I didn't get my first paycheck till like 45 days. So there was a lot of gaps and a lot of times where I needed money and I didn't want to have to ask friends or family or load up on high interest credit cards. So honestly, that's really where Panacea started many years ago, was with this one simple idea of giving doctors access to money when they needed it. And then on the attending side, you know, the big thing there we see people use it for is they have lots of credit cards. They want to consolidate and have lower interest debt. People take out loans, pay off their credit cards, have one low monthly payment. But there's plenty of other uses, especially things like unexpected life costs. And that's really where doctors can run into trouble, because there's unfortunately predatory financial institutions out there that prey on doctors. And so we really view us as a safer alternative for people to go to as a doctor-founded bank to have access to money when they needed it most.
And it is great that Panacea does not require any co-signers on its personal loans or have other hoops that typical banks do. We will link the info about Panacea Financial in the show notes. Panacea Financial is a division of Primis, member FDIC. Welcome to the Core IM 5 Pearls podcast, bringing you high-yield, evidence-based pearls. This is Dr. Shreya Trivedi.
And this is Dr. Anuranita, or Anu Gupta, resident at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Today, we're talking all about immune checkpoint inhibitors and immune-related adverse events, which we will be calling IRAs.
Nice. This is going to be a two-part episode, with this one really setting the foundation for immune checkpoint inhibitors. And then the next episode, we're going to try to elevate the conversation by creating illness scripts to differentiate between IRAs versus other conditions.
So let's get started with the pearls that we'll be covering.
Test yourself by pausing after each of the five questions. Remember, the more you test yourself, the deeper your learning gains.
Pearl 1, mechanism of checkpoint inhibitors and their adverse events.
How do immune checkpoint inhibitors work, and what goes wrong mechanistically when there's an adverse effect?
Pearl 2, organ systems affected by IRAs.
How do you organize the different organ systems that are affected by these immune checkpoint inhibitors?
Pearl 3, timeline of IRAs.
What are rules of thumbs for when different adverse events can present?
Pearl 4, factors which increase susceptibility.
What makes someone more likely to develop an adverse effect?
Pearl 5, complementary medicine.
What role does complementary medicine play in this patient population? I'm so glad you wanted to do an episode on immune checkpoint inhibitors and IRAs as a topic, because I learned so much. I think this whole episode actually was a huge knowledge gap. And so I'm so grateful.
I know. I love this topic, Shreya, and I learned so much too. So let's start from the basics and we'll build up from there. When it comes to immune checkpoint inhibitors, there are two main players, CTLA-4 inhibitors and PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors.
Okay. And then to simplify, which one is which, because all of them end with mab. The good thing is that the CTLA-4 inhibitors, if you see ipilimumab or tremelimumab, am I saying that right, Anu?
That's absolutely right.
Okay. Yeah. So if you see the ipilimumab or the tremelimumab. So if you see ipi and tremi, ipilimumab, tremelimumab, that's CTLA-4 inhibitors. And then all the other ones that end with mab are going to be the PD-1 or the PD-L1 inhibitors, which we can kind of lump together.
And then to understand how immune checkpoint inhibitors work, we first have to understand how our immune system is set up.
And if any of this mechanism goes over your head, don't worry, we're going to repeat ourselves a bunch so it really sticks.
Yeah, repetition is key here. The immune system has careful checks and balances. CTLA-4 and PD-1 are basically checkpoints or breaks. And I want you to remember that these checkpoints are like breaks for the immune system.
Yeah. So cancer, being awful as it is, of course, goes after CTLA-4 and PD-1 and really makes sure that there's a stop on the immune system so that cancer can keep growing.
And then what do these drugs do? CTLA-4 and PD-1 immune checkpoint inhibitors prevent cancer from holding back the immune system.
Yep. And then oncologists give these immune checkpoint inhibitors to free the immune system, and that unhinged immune system then can go and kill the cancer cells. We sat down with Dr. Benjamin Schlechter, an oncologist at Dana-Farber Institute, who thinks about this all the time and explained it so concisely from start to finish.
So the second you activate a T cell, when it takes off into its inflammatory response, it immediately expresses receptors, proteins that put on the brakes. And CTLA-4 is that brake. So the T cell, when it's on, it activates the off switch so it doesn't get out of hand. And what we're drugging with a CTLA-4 inhibitor is the ability of the cancer to push back against amplification of the immune response. And so when you block engagement of CTLA-4, you allow the immune response to amplify early on and in an unfettered way so that it takes off and can attack the cancer.
Okay. I've heard this like turning off the off switch quite a bunch, but it didn't really stick for me. It's like a double negative. So Anu, let's break down this car analogy a bit more.
Okay, let's do it. Imagine there's a car, which is essentially a patient's immune system. It has off switches or brakes like CTLA-4 and PD-1 to keep things in balance. But then a stranger's foot comes along, aka the cancer, and really slams on those brakes or the off switch. So as a result, the cancer grows and grows.
Okay, so then with these immune checkpoint inhibitors, we're taking the cancer's foot, I bet it's a very smelly foot, off those brakes, hence we're turning off the off switch and freeing the immune system to attack the cancer.
Yeah, I'm sure it's smelly. I agree, Shreya. And let's hear from Dr. Allison Warner. She's an oncologist at Stanford Cancer Institute, and she has some thoughts about what happens when these brakes are off and the immune system has a little too much liberty to press on the accelerator pedal of the immune system.
So immune-related adverse events are difficult because they are doing exactly what you're hoping the drug is going to do, which is activate the immune response. The challenge is that your immune cells are looking for self versus non-self. And we are trying to shift that balance so that immune cells recognize cancer as non-self. But when we overactivate them so much, they start recognizing self. And that can look like essentially inflammation anywhere in the body.
Your heart and your lungs and your thyroid and your gonads and everything in your body protects itself from T cells by expressing the ligands of these receptors. So you need PD-1 so you don't develop autoimmune responses against your endothelium, your myocardium, your brain, and whatever it is. And so that's where we get into trouble with these drugs, is that we use those pathways physiologically to protect us from our T cells.
Ah, so the very quality that helps the medication fight cancer can wreak havoc on the body by attacking the patient's own cells.
All right, so let's summarize kind of the ground we've covered. Normally, we have this checks and balance system where we express CTLA-4, PD-1 to put the brakes on the immune system. Cancer really makes sure that off switch, CTLA-4, PD-1 is activated, but immune system is not getting in the way and the cancer can grow. Oncologists then give these immune checkpoint inhibitors to turn off that off switch, allowing the floodgates of the immune system to really let loose and attack the cancer.
What we're going to focus on for the rest of the episode is how these checkpoint inhibitors can cause T cells to be so activated that they start attacking the patient's own cells. And that's how we get our eye rays.
All right, so now that we know how these drugs work a little bit more, let's talk about the adverse events or the eye rays, immune-related adverse events that you wonderful hemonc people call it.
Yeah, I've spent my fair share of time shadowing oncologists, and I've really heard them describing to their patients that eye rays can present as an itis or an inflammation of any organ from skin to gut.
Yeah, which is a little intimidating that it can do so much. So I really appreciated when we sat down with Dr. Nerges Flores, an oncologist at Dana-Farber Institute. I just really appreciated how she had a good, nifty way of organizing all the adverse effects. I thought it would just be a good foundation before we dive deeper a bit more in episode two.
She had a three-tier approach, starting with the most common adverse effects.
Let's talk about the general ones. But the general ones are fatigue. Fatigue is the most common side effect with immune checkpoint inhibitors. And we often forget because it can get to a grade 3 in which the patient is just bedbound and it's only the immunotherapy. So while these drugs are great, they can have this common side effects. So fatigue, nausea is very common, and a skin rash. Itchy skin rash. It's like an eczema kind of skin rash. Those are the most common. Rash, fatigue, and nausea.
And then we get to the second tier in terms of the most common, the glands. And therefore, the thyroid, the adrenals, the pituitary, and then the pancreas.
Let's go over the second tier of common, glands. Glands are the second most common. And that's what we have to have baseline TSH, because 1 out of 8 women, we have some degree of hypothyroidism. So women should have TSH before they start these drugs. So hypothyroidism. But something important with the thyroid is the thyroid gets T cells, right? They get very angry. They go and migrate to the thyroid and produce thyroiditis. So initially with thyroiditis, you will see a decrease in TSH and an increase in T4. And it's a hyperthyroid picture, right? Over time, that thyroid burns down and it becomes hyperthyroid. That's why you have to follow patients and be very careful before you start the hormone. Because if you start it too soon, you're going to get into a very hyperthyroid state. But if you wait too long, they become very hypothyroid.
So thankfully with the thyroid, it's a relatively easy fix with levothyroxine, but the timing is really tricky to get down because these patients get hyperthyroid before they become hypothyroid.
Another gland that can be commonly affected that is often missed is the adrenal glands. We can see significant fatigue. And something that I really notice in these patients, they all feel very dizzy when they stand. So when a patient tells me that I trust that drinks enough water, I feel dizzy when I stand. I'm like, okay, let's figure out what it is. And the cortisol in these patients, because many of them get steroids as pre-medication for chemo, most of them need a stimulation test.
We talked about the thyroids, the adrenals, and now onto the pituitary. So this is usually a central hypopituitarism or hypophysitis. So some of the hormones, or many of them, might be affected.
These patients need a whole brain MRI, because you can see in these patients sometimes inflammation of the pituitary gland and the MRI. And the fourth gland is the pancreas. So you can have pancreatitis and you can have diabetes type 1. Those two are very rare, but they're life-threatening events. I had 3 young women develop DKA, and I was like, all right, here we go again.
Yeah, here we go again. Look up that DKA management chart. All right, so that was the glands. Last but not least of her kind of 3-tier way of organizing the adverse effects is thinking about the solid organs.
So solid organs, the lungs, pneumonitis. And the thing about the pneumonitis is that it can come all of a sudden. You can be doing fine, and then in 2 days, the patient is like, I'm very short of breath. They can have wheezing. So patients can have low-grade fevers. Again, it's a T-cell-mediated process.
Next up, let's think about how these T-cells on overdrive can affect the colon.
The colitis pattern tends to be nonstop diarrhea. So the patient wakes up in the middle of the night for bowel movements. That's very characteristic of this diarrhea. It's 8 to 12 bowel movements from 2 days ago when you have 1 bowel movement a day. 8 to 12 bowel movements. And these patients can decompensate very quickly when it comes to colitis because it's dehydration, poor intake, and nothing gets absorbed. There is, of course, nephritis, which is an inflammation of the kidneys, rare. Cerebritis, everybody likes to talk about cerebritis, but I've seen one case, younger woman, and myocarditis. The situation with myocarditis is rare, but tends to be fatal if it's missed.
Speaking of myocarditis, there is an overlap syndrome that has been described with checkpoint inhibitors that causes myositis, myasthenia gravis, and myocarditis, and it has a really high mortality rate.
This overlap syndrome is something that our colleagues have defined and is critically important that everybody know about, including non-oncologists.
Oh, yeah. I'm glad we went over that. I definitely did not know about this overlap syndrome, but we'll keep a high threshold for myositis, myasthenia gravis, and myocarditis. But this has just been like a whirlwind through the body. And again, we're going to get a lot more into this in episode 2, especially with the solid organs. But why don't we summarize Dr. Flores' framework of how she organizes the different adverse events based on how common they are. The most common is going to be general symptoms of nausea, fatigue, rash. The second most common are going to be the glands, the thyroid, especially initially it's going to be hyperthyroid and then hypothyroid, the adrenals, which often you need a quart stim test to assess. central hypothyroidism where all the hormones are low, and then the pancreas either causing DKA or pancreatitis.
And then with the solid organs, you can get pneumonitis with cough and dyspnea, colitis with profuse diarrhea, and then there's that spooky life-threatening trio of myositis, myasthenia gravis, and myocarditis.
All right, now that we know a bit more about these drugs and what happens when things go awry, let's talk about when these adverse events actually come up. I know as internists, you know, our patients have these complaints, and I think I'm always thinking about that med list and like, okay, is this timeline of these symptoms matching up with the immune checkpoint inhibitor, and can I blame it on that? Ugh.
Yeah, I totally hear you. And just to make our lives extra difficult, not only can these adverse effects occur anywhere in the body, but they can also occur anytime after exposure to the checkpoint inhibitor.
Anytime? Man, that's tough. I mean, are there any general rules of thumb?
So there are a few rules of thumbs. The first being that adverse effects typically show up within 3 months of starting the checkpoint inhibitor.
So different immune-related adverse events tend to occur at different times. The highest risk for any immune-related adverse event is always in the first 3 months. Once we get past the first 3 months, certainly you can have new adverse events. That is always true. But I sort of take one deep breath and say, okay, we're through that highest risk period.
And the type of inhibitor can also help us. We tend to see CTLA-4 adverse effects on the sooner side than the ones from the PD inhibitors.
Oh, interesting. Is that because the inhibitors work at different checkpoints in the immune system, so they show up at different times?
Yeah, so CTLA-4 attenuates T-cell activation in lymph nodes, while PD-1 inhibits T-cells in the peripheral tissues.
Okay, I guess that's kind of convenient, right, in terms of like remembering that, because like the P in PD-1 can help us remember that it's inhibiting checkpoints in the peripheral tissue, and going all the way to the periphery takes time compared to activation in lymph nodes. So PD-1, PD-L1 adverse effects happen later. Maybe one way to think about it.
They do have different presentations and different onset of symptoms. Because CTLA-4 inhibitors, they really have to do with this escalation phase of the immune response. They tend to cause things more acutely. Alternatively, PD-1 inhibitors have to do with exhaustion. And so they are very uncommonly, not impossible, but it's unlikely to see early immune-related adverse events in an average individual in the first 12 weeks. It can happen, but it's just not that common.
So not only do timelines vary by type of immune checkpoint inhibitor, Dr. Warner also told us about how the timeline varies by the organ system.
Things like dermatitis tend to happen on the earlier side, particularly the very worrisome, so myocarditis, which many people know about now and is very, very dangerous and potentially fatal, often happens after the first dose, sometimes the second, but typically within 48 hours, 72 hours of that dose. Colitis can happen at any point, tends to be sort of a 2 to 3 months in type of immune-related adverse event. Interestingly, nephritis tends to be even later in that, you know, 3+ month range. The endocrinopathies are interesting. They can sort of occur kind of anywhere in the spectrum. They tend to not be right after the first dose, though, as I said, anything is possible.
Yep, anything is possible. But as a quick summary, the typical presentation by organ system is going to be skin, rash, itching, pruritus. Myocarditis are going to present on the earlier side, followed by colitis at the 4-week post-exposure to immune checkpoint inhibitors mark. Then endocrinopathies happen later around the 6-week mark. And don't worry, you don't have to memorize any of this. We're going to link a great graphic in the show notes that kind of shows all the variabilities of these timelines.
And then another pro tip is that we don't often see pneumonitis and nephritis with CTLA-4 inhibitors alone. And we need the PD or PD-L1 inhibitors or a combination of those with CTLA-4 in order to cause pneumonitis and nephritis in this subacute period of around 3 months or so.
Okay, so we either need the big bad PD-1 inhibitors or we need both immune checkpoint inhibitors to really be on board to go against the lungs and the kidneys.
Exactly. And then on top of that, there is something called delayed IRAs.
Oof, what? I do not like the sound of that, Anu.
Yeah, it's not good. Delayed IRAs are adverse effects that actually occur 1 year after therapy starts. This could be while they are still getting the immune checkpoint inhibitor since treatment courses are long, or after the last dose has been given.
Man, that's such a good pearl, because I know when we're looking at these one-liners or the huge onc history that is written, I guess it's good to see when that immune checkpoint inhibitor was started, when that last dose was. I mean, are there things that make people more prone to delayed immune checkpoint inhibitors 1 year after immune checkpoint inhibitor initiation?
Yeah, generally delayed IRAs are going to be people who unfortunately had an acute IRA prior. Most frequently, these are colitis, rash, and pneumonitis.
Okay, so have you seen delayed IRAs come up?
Yeah, Shreya. So I actually saw this recently when I was in the ICU, and we thought one of our patients had adrenal insufficiency, but we weren't sure because, you know, they had finished getting their checkpoint inhibitor a few months prior when their treatment course had ended. And so we wondered if that timeline could fit. And now we know delayed IRAs are a real thing.
Yeah, these timelines are so wild. And I think like just reinforces, right? Things can truly happen whenever, even though you guys did give us some rules of thumbs and also happen in a delayed fashion.
Yeah, totally. And then bear with me, Shreya, there's one more distinction that we have to make. The third rule of thumb is that we can have something called the chronic IRAs. And this is when the adverse effect persists for greater than 12 weeks after the checkpoint inhibitor is stopped.
We have data that this immunotherapy can stay in target for up to 9 months from the last dose. And patients can have immune-related adverse event. This is a very good point. Even after they stop getting the drug, right? After. Because that monoclonal antibody is still there. Your T cells are still active.
Ugh. Man, so if immunotherapy can stay in someone's system for 9 months after stopping it, I guess then it makes sense why we might see these chronic IRA side effects going on for 4 months out, which, ugh, that just feels so bad for the patients who get that.
I know, it's not ideal to say the least. So now that we've covered all this ground, why don't we summarize this pearl?
Yeah, so things I'm taking away, yes, it's true, IRAs can occur at any time, but some things to hang our hats on is thinking that acute IRAs are most likely going to happen in the first 3 months of starting an immune checkpoint inhibitors. And within that, it's going to be the CTLA-4 inhibitors, the one, if I remember correctly, the ipilimumab and the tremelimumab that act on the T cells in the lymph nodes and tend to cause adverse effects on the earlier side, really within that first 3 months. And then PD-1 inhibitors act on the T cells in the periphery and tend not to present as quickly.
And then in terms of the organs, the skin and the heart might be affected the earliest. Colitis usually comes on after a month or so, and then nephritis in the first 3 months or so. But again, these are all just general rules of thumb.
Yeah. And then Anu, I think before closing out this pearl, I can't help but wonder, you know, we're talking about all these IRAs that are happening all the time, and it's often treated with steroids. But the whole point of these immune checkpoint inhibitors is to let the immune system run free. So I'm curious, doesn't dampening down the immune system with steroids decrease the anti-tumor effect that we're hoping to get all along with these immune checkpoint inhibitors?
That is such a good question, Shreya. And I totally get where it's coming from. Mechanistically, it makes sense. But really, it doesn't pan out clinically. Steroids don't take away from the immune checkpoint inhibitor's ability to attack the cancer. But as with most things, we do need more research in this area.
Okay. At least it's helpful to hear. And I'm sure as our patients ask us, hey, like, is the steroids going to affect my ability to battle this cancer? I think it's at least good to say, hey, this doesn't pan out clinically and you should feel comfortable kind of treating the adverse effects with steroids. Now let's turn the spotlight to another critical aspect, which is who are the patients that get IRAs more? Are there some people that are just more susceptible to it?
That is really the question at the heart of personalized medicine. This is a hot research topic, and hopefully in the future, we'll be able to tailor our decision-making to the patient in front of us.
Okay, so I think if I were to guess, just knowing that immune checkpoint inhibitors make the immune system attack, you know, our own organ, I bet if someone has pre-existing autoimmune disease, prior organ transplant, maybe that'll make the immune system more sensitive and reactive to these immune checkpoint inhibitors.
Right. It's like having a security system that's on high alert. Introducing these checkpoint inhibitors can push it into overdrive.
So immune-related adverse events, if we had a biomarker that predicted who would get immune-related adverse events, we would be much further along in our field. The things that we do know make that more likely is having baseline autoimmune disease. So patients who have underlying autoimmune disease seem to be at much higher risk of both flares of their particular autoimmune disease as well as other autoimmune effects. And we think that it's essentially that their set point is a little bit higher, right? Their baseline immune activation is a little bit higher.
If a patient has a distant history of immune dysfunction, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, something like that, some squirrely diagnosis of RA or a rheumatoid factor that was positive, I'm comfortable using these, but carefully, and I counsel the patients around them because you may reactivate that process.
So immune checkpoint inhibitors are not off the table in patients with autoimmune conditions, but definitely merit some careful consideration before starting. And all our oncologists did warn us that in our patients who have transplant, they just need a lot more hands to help avoid rejection of that transplanted organ.
Yeah, that is so important. And then the risk factor that I'm the most fascinated about is how our own microbiota and GI flora plays into all of this.
It's fascinating how the gut flora is connected to so much. And I'm surprised it's playing a role here too.
Yeah, definitely with the mind-gut connection. And now it's really interesting to think about the fact that the gut microbiome might even play a role in the immune therapy response.
So patients who are not heavily pretreated with antibiotics have a much more diverse population of microbes in their gut. And those who've been exposed to antibiotics chronically or multiple times have reduced variety in their microbiome, and that may promote immune dysfunction. So patients who have been heavily pretreated with antibiotics, who have a decreased variety of microbes for the Peyer's patches and the innate tissue immunity of the colon to manage, they're more likely to have immune-related adverse events. And that's sort of borne out in a number of retrospective analyses. What we don't have is prospective analyses trying to, say, add a microbiome, a stool microbiome transplant, for example, or give probiotics.
So interesting. It makes me wonder how much antibiotic exposure does it take, or if PPIs or probiotics affects the GI flora in these cases. I'm sure people are doing active studies on that at the moment, but it definitely motivates me to diversify my microbiome and not just like reach for the same old salad that I reach for, but very hard when I have a three-year-old who just wants pizza and mac and cheese every night.
You know, that's very relatable, Shreya, but I agree with you. Variety is the spice of life, they say.
Oh, I sound like a true Indian.
So the last risk factor that we should be on the lookout for is someone who's on a combination of both CTLA-4 and PD inhibitors.
Yeah, and that makes sense. Two immune checkpoint inhibitors together, we're just really freeing up that immune system, dialing up the intensity of an IRA to happen.
So as a recap, who is at higher risk of complications? It's going to be people with pre-existing autoimmune disease, solid organ transplants, and if they're on both types of immune checkpoint inhibitors. Lastly, we're still learning more about the impact of prior antibiotic exposure and the gut microbiome. Let's talk about an overlooked topic by most of us and something that we really should get comfortable asking all of our patients about.
And one of the most common things in patients with cancers is complementary medicine. I believe in it. I also believe in honesty. So when I see a patient with liver dysfunction, my first question is, did somebody send you a message via Facebook that you should try a tea? And sometimes it's yes. So I have seen a lot of patients that have been called hepatitis induced by immunotherapy, but it has to be, sometimes it's complementary medicine. So a very good med rec is very important. Patients with cancer, they want to do everything they can. And that includes teas, alkaline water, coffee ground enemas, these pills here, these influencer there.
Oh, I'm so glad she is bringing this up. I certainly need to do a better job asking specifically what else, you know, my patients may be taking, especially when things like hepatitis are on the table.
And then I say, if you have started something, go home, look at it. If you found something new, send a picture, send it to the patient portal. Boom. When they go home, they remember. And it was a tea. It was a root-based tea that somebody brought from Taiwan that has these mushrooms. Then what we did is we are like, no more complementary medicine, no more immunotherapy. Let's see how your liver behaves in 2 weeks. And so that we saw the liver improving. So I didn't start her on steroids. So hepatitis induced by immune checkpoint inhibitors doesn't get better on their own because that monoclonal antibodies stays in target for a very, very long time.
And that is how she discovers that liver dysfunction is related to things that are not showing up on someone's typical med rec and saves them from steroids they did not need.
Yeah, what a win. And that being said, when we do see possible hepatitis, we have to do our due diligence and work up all of the other causes as well.
And we have to route the common culprits, right? So hepatitis virus needs to be done and high alcohol consumption and also high acetaminophen intake. A lot of patients with cancer have metastasis to bone and they can take a lot of acetaminophen. So hepatitis is very common. You will see AST and ALT to be elevated at the same time. As it rises, then the bilirubin follows. And that's when we get in trouble.
So to recap this quick but important pearl, our patients may be using complementary medicine. And yes, it certainly does have its place. And so we should ask about teas, powders, and other supplements they may be taking. And we will link to specific websites that we learned about in the Core IM Alternative Medicine at the Bedside episode. It's so good if you haven't listened to it. These websites make it really easy to look up complementary medicine and what their side effects may be.
And if we are concerned about hepatitis, we should do our general workup, assessing for hepatitis virus, DILI, alcohol use, etc. There are plenty of helpful schemas and algorithms that help us to do just this. That wraps up our clinical pearls on immune checkpoint inhibitor adverse events.
If you found this episode helpful, please share this with your team, colleagues, give it a rating on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast app you use. It really does help people find us.
This episode was made in part of the digital education track at BIDMC. Thank you to all the educators and mentors, and thank you to our peer reviewers, Dr. Tian Zhang and Dr. Hollis Vire.
Thank you to Dr. Bhatia for audio editing, as well as Dr. Kathy Sisson for the accompanying graphics. As always, we love hearing feedback. Email us at hello@coreimpodcast.com. Opinions expressed are our own and do not represent the opinions of any affiliate institutions.